Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. What a great weekend, by the way. Friday, thanks again, a tip of the hat, and thanks so much to the fine folks at KJFK. And great call letters in Reno, Nevada. And I'm so pleased to be there. And then on Saturday, that Saturday evening, gave the keynote for Los Angeles Mensa, and thanks to the fine folks at Mensa who showed up and all the K-Talk listeners who showed up. And that was a great success. We had a lot of fun, and I wasn't quite as intimidated as I thought I would be by being in front of a couple hundred of the smartest people in the entire world, or the entire Los Angeles metro area anyway, although there were people from all over the place. But today, in our second hour, we're going to get into whether or not we should be privatizing the post office and things like that. In our third hour, we're going to get into some labor issues. But in this hour, I'd like to ask the question, are conservative policies producing entire generations of damaged Americans? And I would add, as I go through this, I'd like you to think also about how, you know, 15 years ago, Iraq, for example, was not a poor country. It was a very wealthy country with a very strong and large middle class. You know, they had a despot and his two crazy sons running the country. But by and large, that aside, and obviously you can't just easily toss that aside, but like so many nations in the world that are run by despots, or unlike so many nations in the world that are run by despots, at least Iraq had a strong middle class. No longer. Now the second largest refugee crisis in the world coming out of Iraq, and you know, more than 50 to 60% of the population unemployed. Poverty is rampant. Malnutrition is rampant. And so this whole issue of poverty and happiness, you know, what works and what doesn't, that is really interesting. There's two pieces that I want to share with you about this. In fact, I talked about one of them at the Mensa meeting Saturday night. The first part is, I don't know if you saw 60 Minutes last night, but CBS News was pointing out, and, you know, this was not their research. This is, survey after survey. In fact, they point out over 30 years, the results have consistently been the same, that the people of Denmark are the happiest people in the world. Why would that be? And last night they were, you know, really struggling with this thing on 60 Minutes, and they kind of mentioned in passing, because I don't think that they could avoid it, frankly, what I believe are the real reasons why Denmark is the happiest place in the world, which I'll get to in just a second. And then they spent most of the show trying to figure out, well, maybe it's because they have low expectations. And if you have low expectations, then you're not disappointed when you don't reach them. And that became the kind of, you know, well, this is our story and we're sticking to it. But the fact, and as 60 Minutes points out, they say this is from the show last night. It's hard to figure. The weather's only so-so. They're heavy drinkers and smokers. Their neighbors, the Norwegians, are richer, and their other neighbors, the Swedes, are healthier. So why would the Danes be the happiest people in the world? Well, for example, all education is free, right up to a PhD. You can take as long as you want. You can go as far as you want. As long as you can keep passing the tests, you can stay in school. And, in fact, you even get paid to go to school. If you have a child, 6 months, 100% paid maternity or paternity leave. They have completely free health care. Everybody is covered. No worry about pre-existing conditions. No nonsense about, you know, this or that or the other thing with, you know, you've got to pay this, you know, part of the pharmaceuticals and that, you know, the drug company lobbies and you know, it's there. They have subsidized child care. If you have children, they will take care of them. No problem. You know, kids, free preschool, free education, no charge whatsoever, and it's good. It's high-quality stuff. And elder care. When you get old and you're retiring, there are in your home, they'll provide for you. They have the equivalent of a Social Security system. It's very generous. And if you need care in a facility, the facilities are very nice. They're very high quality. and they take care of you right up until the day you die. No questions asked, and it's free. Now, it's not really free. The Danes pay about 50% taxes, about 50% of their income in taxes. But for them, apparently, they're saying, hey, this is a reasonable trade-off. I'd be glad to pay half of my income in taxes if it meant that my entire society knew that they were always safe. That safety and security, at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, was always met. By the way, the average work week in Denmark, 37 hours. Americans are working increasingly 50, 60, 70 hours a week, two and three jobs. In Denmark, 37 hours, and the government requires employers to provide 6 weeks a year of vacation. Not bad. Say, it's socialism. Well, it's not communism-style socialism. This is democratic socialism, if you want to call it that, and it works. Paul Krugman today in the New York Times writing about how poverty is poison. He points out LBJ declared his war on poverty 44 years ago. Contrary to cynical legend, there actually was a large reduction in poverty over the next few years. In fact, he reduced poverty in the United States about 40% over the next 4 years and arguably over the next 5, 10, 15 years, depending on how you define poverty and whether you're talking about child poverty or family poverty, but basically cut it in half. Poverty rate for children went from 23% in 1963 to 14% in 1969. Today, we're back up to 17.9%. And because our population is much larger, it's almost twice what it was when LBJ was president, there's a lot more kids living in poverty here in the United States. And this is where we get to a study that I first wrote about. I first came across this stuff back about 5 or 6 years ago when I was writing my last book on attention deficit disorder. I have 7 books in print on ADHD and learning styles, learning disabilities, you know, all that kind of thing, mostly ADHD. And the last one is called The Edison Gene, you know, suggesting that the genetics for ADHD, primarily the dopamine transporter genes, the DRD4, DRD2, DT genes, that these are actually adaptive and useful. And in that book, in The Edison Gene, I quoted a lot of research that came out of Alan Shore's book, Affect Regulation and the Origin of the Self, is the title of Alan Shore's book, and over 2,000 footnotes in this book. I mean, it's just this massive tome, an extraordinary amount of research. And what Alan Shore found was that throughout gestation, all the time that a baby is developing in the womb, that developing fetus, literally from the very beginning, all the way up until birth, is constantly asking the mother, is the world that I'm going to be born into a safe place or a dangerous place? And if the answer is it's a dangerous place, then the baby will develop its hindbrain, its fight-or-flight brain, its violence brain more. And the forebrain, the part of the brain that engages in thinking and understanding and compassion and things like that, gets diminished. On the other hand, if the message coming back from the mother is, no, the world is a safe place, then the forebrain, the front brain, gets developed more highly, and the hindbrain is less developed. And so you get a child who perhaps is less physically facile or competent, but far more intellectually competent and emotionally competent. And the way that the mother communicates this to the child is with a hormone called cortisol. When she experiences stress, her cortisol levels go up. As a consequence of those increased cortisol levels, the child's brain actually changes. Well, it turns out, and I wrote a whole chapter about this 5 years ago, 6 years ago in The Edison Gene. Turns out it's not just through gestation. This was in the Financial Times over the weekend. I read it on an airplane and said, whoa, here it is. Poverty in early, this is Clive Cookson in Boston writing in the Financial Times. Poverty in early childhood poisons the brain. The American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting in Boston heard on Friday. Neuroscientists say that many children growing up in poor families with low social status experience unhealthy levels of stress hormones, which impair their neural development. Now, this is after birth. It continues. Studies by several U.S. universities have revealed the pervasive harm done to the brain, particularly between the ages of 6 months and 3 years, from low socioeconomic status. Martha Farah, director of the University of Pennsylvania Center for Cognitive Neuroscience, said the biggest effects are on language and memory. The finding about memory impairment, the ability to encounter a pattern and remember it really surprised us. They say this is really important because after three, the brain starts to lose its plasticity, its adaptivity. So when children grow up in poverty, they grow up in high-stress homes. You know, keep in mind, money is the main cause of divorce. Living in poverty is a stressful situation. Not knowing if you're going to lose your home, not knowing if a disease is going to wipe out the family. You know, living in poverty is stressful. And so here we have these two studies. One, essentially no poverty. A good, strong social safety net makes people, the Danes, the happiest people in the world. And two, the poverty in the United States is actually causing our children to be wired to be dysfunctional. It's extraordinary.
I think we need a gunslinger. Somebody tough to tame this town. I think we need a gunslinger. There'll be justice all around. I think we need a gunslinger. Somebody tough to tame this town.
Yeah, somebody like Franklin Roosevelt. Shoot up the town. Say, okay, you cons. I mean, here's the question. Are conservative policies producing a generation, or have they produced multiple generations of damaged Americans? Not just unhappy, but damaged. I mean, this is the kind of thing, it's called generative. It produces more of itself. So in Denmark, you have free public education all the way up to a PhD. You can take as long as you need, as long as you keep passing the test, you can get any. So they have a very highly educated populace, a very strong and educated workforce. National health care insurance. Anybody can get any kind of health care they want anytime. Old age benefits that absolutely make it safe to grow old. Child care benefits and mandated 6 weeks vacation, an average 37-hour work week. I mean, it's a society that works. The happiest people in the world. And then here in the United States, we find that among the industrialized countries of the world, we have the highest poverty rate among them. Obviously not one of the highest poverty rates in the world, but look at the damage that poverty does. I mean, when Lyndon Johnson was talking about cutting poverty in half in the United States back in the 1960s, it was a moral issue. John Edwards talked about poverty. He made it the centerpiece of his campaign, framing it as a moral issue. I would say it goes way beyond a moral issue. It goes right to being essentially a social and political issue. It becomes a scientific issue, a neurobiological issue, a what kind of future generations of people are we producing? Are we producing these high cortisol, strong hindbrain, very fast fight or flight response, very quick to violence individuals? And once, after the age of three, it's pretty much burned in. Is that the kind of person we're developing? Or are we creating a society of individuals who have a high-functioning intellect and high-functioning emotional intelligence? Which is it going to be? And as our society has gotten more and more stressed out over the last 15, 20 years, arguably 30 years, ever since Reagan declared war on the middle class, we've seen since the late 70s, since the early 80s, since Ronald Reagan came into office, we have seen average wages, real purchasing power wages of average working people actually decline at the same time that the cost of living for the things that working people have to pay for have exploded. And thus we see that, the single worker family with, dad works and mom stays at home, or mom works and dad stays at home, and the kids always have a parent around, they can buy a house and a car and put their kids through school with a single job that you can get, with a free education. In my dad's generation, that was a high school diploma. In Denmark, it could be a PhD. It's a free education, go as far as you can. That's the American dream. And it's gone. One of the things that I thought was particularly ironic was at the very end of the 60 Minutes interview last night, they were talking with one of the Danes, and he made some reference to the American dream. And the essence of it was that he believed that the American dream was to get rich. And that's not the American dream. The American dream has always been, all the way back to the founding of this country, has been to have a good, stable life, to be able to provide for your family, raise your kids, know that you're safe. I mean, basically, safety, security, make it work. It was Ronald Reagan who came along and said, well, let's recalibrate the American dream. Let's make it be about, getting rich. And in fact, if you look at the studies, if you look at the annual surveys that are done of school children by like Scholastic Magazine and others, you know, for a long, long time, throughout the 40s and the 50s and 60s and 70s, who's your favorite person? Who do you want to be like? I want to be like George Washington or Abraham Lincoln. You know, I want to be president. I want to be a servant of the people. I want to do things, great things. Dag Hammarskjöld, you know, the Secretary General of the United Nations, was a great hero to many of us. I mean, he was one of my great heroes in the 1950s and as a child. And now it's everybody wants to be like Bill Gates. What, you think billions will make you happy? In fact, you know, there's a fair body of evidence that indicates that once you've reached that minimum threshold or that comfortable threshold of knowing that your old age is safe, your health is safe, and that your home is not going to be lost, that your job is secure, that after that point, acquiring more stuff tends to make people crazier. It tends to make them less happy. Now, apropos of that, so I guess, you know, we could summarize that by saying, well, a well-educated, well-informed, stable, safe workforce, good thing. Middle class, good thing. Poverty, bad. Poverty produces more poverty. People say, well, why are the children of poor people not so bright? It must be that they're all, maybe that's why they're poor, because they're dumb, right? No, it's that poverty is producing dumbness, as it were. Chemically, we're talking biology here. It is producing brains that do not achieve their intellectual potential or their emotional potential, but have achieved their fight or flight potential. They sure do know how to instantly respond and pull a gun or hit somebody in the upside the head, something like that. And meanwhile, the Bush administration now taking down websites, government websites, that give us information on the rates of poverty, how the economy is doing, how the middle class is doing in the United States, because things are getting worse and they don't want us to know. Well, George, we know. Republicans, we know. And we're going to do something about it in the elections in November. Tom Hartman, give us a call. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our local radio stations, our affiliates, and our sponsors, particularly our local sponsors, as well as our national sponsors, such as SEIU 1199, 200,000 health and hospital workers working for affordable, universal health care coverage. Because in this country, they believe, I believe, we all believe, that healthcare should be a right, like it is in Denmark, not a privilege, like it is in the United States. 1-866-303-2270, our phone number. TomHartman.com, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room or participate in our blog. And Claudio in Canada.
How are you, Tom?
Hey, Claudio, I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Oh, I just wanted to say I watched that 60 Minutes interview as well, and I thought we had it good in Canada. Boy. We're fighting for some of the same things that they have, child care that's been funded by the government. We're trying to get that implied as well into our system. We are happier here, and basically it has to do with health care and education. Mm. For a country of 30 million people, we have on average of about 560 murders a year for 30 million people. Wow. And don't think that we don't have guns. Per capita, we have more guns than Americans do.
Yeah, I know. Michael Moore pointed that out in his Bowling for Columbine movie. And it's because poverty is dramatically lower in Canada. You have a social safety net that prevents that. You know, 50% of all bankruptcies in the United States are the result of people getting sick.
Yeah,
I mean, how strange is that?
Well, listen, if you do not have the two pillars of a great society, which are health care and education, if someone is not healthy, they're not going to be productive. And if someone is not educated, they're not going to further advance the country.
Right. They're not going to be productive also.
Exactly.
And I remember when Ronald Reagan, I mean, back in the 60s, a lot of friends of mine went out to California to go to college at the University of California because it was one of the last ones that was still free. And you know, the whole land-grant university thing in my parents' generation, my mother went to Michigan State University, and during the summers, she propped airplanes and washed airplanes, in part in exchange for pilot lessons. But she also worked as a lifeguard up in Charlevoix, Michigan, where she grew up. And literally, that was enough money to put her through college because it was so cheap. It was subsidized by the state, Michigan State University, the land-grant colleges, the state colleges. And I remember when Reagan said, we're not going to do that anymore. No more free education in California. And somebody asked him why, and he said, why should I pay to have kids protest something I disagree with? I mean, it's the conservatives have raped this country. And they're trying to do it to your country, too, by the way.
They're trying to. But, you know, most 95% of this country is liberal.
Yeah.
And we like it that way.
Yeah.
It is what Americans don't understand is that it is your money that's in Washington. Why don't you have your money work for you instead of working for corporations?
Yeah. Instead of a $680 billion defense budget, we spend more on defense than every other nation in the world combined. We've got Star Wars. We've spent $3.5 trillion on it.
53 cents of every American dollar spent on the military. I'm sorry, but Europe does not need your protection.
Yeah. Well said, and neither does
you guys.
Canada.
Exactly. Someone should stand up and say, excuse me, but since when does Europe, who has a stronger dollar, who is economically is becoming just as powerful as the United States, why do we have to protect them?
Right. And France and the UK are actually nuclear powers. Yeah, Claudio, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Well said. Very well said. Will in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Will.
Oh, yeah. Kucinich address those issues. But the reason I'm calling is I was in Denmark in May visiting a family of a girl who had been over here as an exchange student. She was 17. She had a job at what she called a fast food restaurant, and was being paid 100 krone an hour. At the time, that was $17, and now it's almost 20.
Wow.
So not only have we lost, they've gained 10% on us or more in those time, but but my point was that
they have a very high minimum wage. They want to make sure that
right,
no,
but to pay that 10% or to pay that 50%, they're still making more than any entry-level person in this
that's,
country.
That's right, and that's one of the great lies about taxes. You know, everybody says, oh, you know, we want to cut your taxes. Well, the fact of the matter is that let's say that you make $50,000 a year and you're paying 30% of it in tax, or let's say you're paying half of it in taxes, just to make the math really easy.
Mm-hmm.
That means you're taking home $25,000 a year. That means your employer knows that you're willing to work for $25,000 a year in your pocket. Now, if George W. Bush came along and actually cut taxes on the middle class, I mean, he doesn't. He cuts taxes on the millionaires and billionaires. But if he actually cut your taxes in half so that now instead of taking home $25,000, you're taking home closer to $40,000, your employer would say, well, wait a minute. I know he'll work for $25,000 a year, so I'm going to reduce his salary from $50,000 a year down to $43,000 a year, whatever, so that he's still making that $25,000 a year. In other words, or on the other hand, as Bill Clinton came along and raised taxes, 4 or 5%, or Franklin Roosevelt raised taxes dramatically, I mean up to 90-91% after you make $3.2 million a year. And what happened? Wages went up so that at the end of the day, your disposable income is the same. And the question is, what kind of society do we want to live in? And that's where the divide comes with the cons versus the liberals. I'm sorry, Will. I had already pushed the button there and
Hello.
I missed your last statement. Hey, Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida. You're on. Hey, Phil.
Yeah, hi. You know, one thing that I heard Laura Ingraham criticizing that 60 Minutes interview and stuff, and you know, one thing they didn't realize is Denmark still manufactures things like high-quality loudspeakers, Dyne Audio,
right,
and a bunch of others.
Yeah.
That they have not.
And they do so
China.
Because they have import laws that make it expensive to import competitors from cheap labor countries. And you know, obviously they encourage their exports. In other words, they have a trade policy that protects them. We had a trade policy like that in the United States from the 1790s until the 1980s. And then Reagan began systematically dismantling our trade policies Carter actually had something to do with it, but it really got on steroids under Reagan. And then George Herbert Walker Bush with his New World Order, and then Bill Clinton with NAFTA and GATT, the WTO, and now all these trade deals. And bottom line, yeah, we don't make anything here anymore, and all the more the tragedy. Bob, is it in Orange County, California?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Well, you really hit a nerve with a question that I've been trying to answer for the past 30 years of my life. Reagan codified what began in the Nixon administration. This goes back to why our parents was the last great generation. Our parents' generation was the last to receive a true liberal arts education that was based upon the educational philosophies created by the founders of this country in the Age of Enlightenment.
Right.
A well-rounded Socratic education, an education
where you were challenged and you could challenge authority, you could question things. Yeah.
Yes, but its basic philosophy goes all the way back to the Greeks, to Aristotle. In De Anima, Aristotle asked the question, what is it to be truly human? And his answer was, to be truly human, there had to be a balance between the search for truth and the search for justice,
right,
and the search for beauty. We come out with the discipline of philosophy, everything regarding truth all the way down to mathematics. Our first mathematicians were philosophers.
Yep.
They were not scientists.
And vice versa.
And then ethics, the search for justice, and then aesthetics, defining what was beautiful. And to the Greeks, what was beautiful was patterned after the archetype of the beautiful human body.
Right, and it also included things like wisdom.
I mean,
exactly. These were considered, Plato and the shadows in the cave, the archetypal stuff, everything that, preceded everything else. It was all, you're absolutely right. And that generation, you're right, that generation was the last generation to have that education. And some of us old farts, I suppose, but it's, to some extent. But again, the Reagan guys just took the whole thing apart. They just took it apart on us. Brandon in California. Hey, Brandon, what's up?
Hey there, Tom.
Hey, Brandon.
Caller. You know, I really wanted to agree with your position on how pop.
Brandon? Oh, Brandon's cell phone must have vanished. So, Randall in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Randall, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. All right, first time caller. Yeah, I saw the 60-minute show as well, and I've been married to a Danish woman for about 18 years, been to Denmark pretty much every year for the last, 15, 16 years. And a lot of Americans, like you said, socialism, it's a bad thing. But, I mean, I think there's the ability of an American, like you said, 50% of all bankruptcies are caused by a medical situation.
Additional third are caused by divorce, in other words, loss of income.
Divorce. Yeah, it's just like, it's crazy that, like you said, I would gladly pay more in taxes to have a society where a guy doesn't have to get up, get in an accident, know that if his leg comes off, he's going to be bankrupt. It's just crazy. I mean, I hope the Obama or Hillary's health campaign can get some legs and we can finally bring this type of medicine to America. We really need it.
Yeah, well said, Randall. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for the validation. You know, the BBC did a study. I'm sure Sue has the link over in our chat room some years ago. They found that whenever conservative administrations came into power in the UK, suicides went up. Yep.
Even if your hands are shaking and your faith is broken, even as the eyes are closing,
yeah, get out there and tell it like it is. It works in Denmark. It works in Sweden. It works in Norway. It works in France. It works in the United Kingdom. Why can't we make it work here? Conceivably we could. Before we continue with your phone calls, just our crazy alert for the day. Oh, man. No, but I got to tell you, Glenn Beck's gone off the edge. Probably, yeah. Started about 4 or 5 years ago with Limbaugh's famous...
I have long told you, for example, Undeniable Truth of Life number 24, written back in 1987, feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women easier access to the mainstream of society. And even to this day, people poo-poo this and say it's insensitive. How could you possibly say something like that? Well, because I mean it. Because I believe there's something to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, feminism is about empowering ugly women. What? And then Glenn Beck, how did this guy get on CNN? I am just totally baffled by this.
Ugly people, if you're a guy, you can get past it. I don't think you can as an ugly woman. I don't. If you're an ugly woman, I apologize. Oh, you've got to double cross, because if you're an ugly woman, you're probably a progressive as well. Oh, jeez. I'm sorry. Today is just not your day.
Glenn.
You know what? If you believed in God, you'd know that there's going to be another chance for you.
Yeah, when you're dead.
You don't have to be ugly in heaven. You're going to be your perfect
self. Just wait till you're dead.
And there will be another perfect somebody waiting for you on the other side.
Oh, man. It's like, just pick that cotton, my friends. Just pick that cotton, and someday heaven is waiting for you. Oh. Glenn Beck, our crazy person for the day. 866-303-2270, our phone number is Rob in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Tom, thank you so much for taking my phone call. I love your show.
Thanks. What's up?
I just want to say that you're talking about the tax rate in Denmark and being at 50% and so much higher than our tax rate. It's really not. If you factor in... health insurance premiums, and then you factor in copay, deductible, out-of-pocket expenses. Then you factor in daycare, child care on top of that. Then you factor in saving for college. We're already at 50%.
We're already well over 50%. And
exactly.
What's happening is instead of government bureaucrats, you know, the guys with the green eye shades making a reasonable but relatively middle-class salary with a decent pension and a good union job,
exactly.
Instead of those people doing the, you know, providing the services, making sure that all this works, and at a 2 or 3% total overhead cost, because it's just a very simple government bureaucracy that's responsible to us. Instead, we have for-profit corporations where you've got people sucking millions, billions of dollars out of your and my expenses in all of those categories that you just talked about, Rob, or Bob, rather. And they're making out like bandits. Their stockholders are making out like bandits, and the rest of us are getting screwed, and you're absolutely right. We might as well call it taxes, because that's what it is. It's coming out of our pockets. And it's incredible. Peter in Blaine, Washington. Hey, Peter.
Yeah, hi. I'm just a little bit baffled here. I'm an ugly man, so how does that explain my being progressive?
Well, according to Glenn Beck, just wait. You'll be fine in heaven.
That's right.
I mean,
I'll be beautiful and I'll be a Republican.
Right. This is so sick it's twisted. I mean, it's just so sick it's twisted. And these are the guys who want to tell us how to run our economy and make people happy, right?
Right.
Yeah, just wait till you get to heaven.
Right. So anyway, I just wanted to point out, I live in Blaine, Washington, which is pretty much as far north and west as you can get in the lower 48, right on the Canadian border. I talk to Canadians daily, and I always ask them, would you change, you know, trade what you guys have there for what we got here? And they laugh in my face.
Yeah, it's not like we're seeing a lot of, you know, in the whole illegal immigration debate, it's not like we're seeing Canadians pouring across the border. And you want to talk about a porous border that you can simply walk across.
That's true. I mean, we have the beautiful Peace Arch here that's a lovely park, and you can walk right across at will.
Yeah, I mean, up in Vermont, there's a little town up in Vermont where I used to do book signings and book readings in this library where there was a yellow line that ran through the middle of the room in the library. And the Derby Center is the name of the town.
Uh-huh.
And the yellow line in the middle of the library, if you stepped on one side of the line, you were in Canada. On the other side of the line, you were in the United States. This was
uh-huh.
a town that, like, straddled the two countries. It's amazing.
Uh-huh.
And no, there was not a steady stream of Canadians coming into America. Instead, once a week, Bernie Sanders was organizing busloads of elderly people to go up to Canada to buy their pharmaceuticals. That was what was going on. Peter, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Tom in Ohio. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good morning. Good afternoon from the Buckeye State.
There you go. Thank you.
Hey, I'm just really hoping and praying that when President Clinton or President Obama get in office, that either kidnap you or get like-minded individuals like yourself as advisors, because I've been listening to your program now for about a year, and everything you say, I mean, I'm just right on nails with.
Well, thank you.
But the two questions I have, I'll just get with one today, and the guy just said 60% in Denmark, which I didn't hear before, and I didn't see the 60-minute piece. But I was having kids 11, 8, and 5. You know, I just want to make the world has to be a better place. We shouldn't, healthcare going up 40-50% in the last 5 years. And with the cost of education anymore, I know my father was a brilliant man. And he always said, you know, the great equalizer back in the sword age was the gun. But the great equalizer today in a civilized society is education.
That's right.
We have to, you know, if the kids have the brain matter, and they have the desire to want to do education, make themselves better, it's going to make us better in the long run. We just have to do something to take that effect.
Absolutely. Well said, Tom. Thanks a lot for the call and for the comment. That is the bottom line. Are we going to invest in our children and in our future, or are we going to continue to be moving all of our resources to millionaires and billionaires and screw the middle class? And apropos of that, coming up next, a conversation about should we privatize the post office? More opportunities for profit. Stick around.
You're in the Democracy Zone. Democracy with Zone. Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. The smart people get their news.
So, shall we privatize more of the commons, or is the Postal Service inappropriately considered part of the commons? You know, the stuff that we all collectively own, like government and parks and air and water and our roads and all that sort of thing. Robbie Shrum is with us. He's a fellow with the Lexington Institute. LexingtonInstitute.org is their website. And Robbie, you're arguing that we should sell off the post office to private corporations, right?
First of all, it's good to be with you. And I wouldn't
Thank
say I'm exactly saying that we should sell off the postal service to private corporations, but I do think that there are some big merits to opening the postal market to competition.
Here in Portland, there was a big brouhaha. One of the local communities was growing quite fast. And so the Postal Service, at the encouragement of some local conservative politicians, my understanding, decided to basically outsource the postal services to one community in the neighborhood or in the town. And the people in the community freaked out. They were like, you know, hey, wait a minute. The guy who was the pizza delivery guy last week is delivering my credit card bills and my Social Security check and my paycheck and all kinds of private and confidential information this week. And next week, he might be working someplace else. I'd rather have a government employee who has, you know, 30 years and a pension, who really is committed to their job, who's a true professional and cares about it, who sees it as a career, and who is accountable to the federal government, because it is a federal felony to mess with the mail. I'd rather have that than have the pizza delivery guy from down the street handling my mail, thank you very much. And the town actually, you know, decided, okay, great, we're going to deprivatize this.
Well, I think that allowing contract workers to deliver mail, especially to some outlying, you know, new subdivisions, things of that nature, can be a real financial benefit to the Postal Service. But those contract workers have to go through the same screening processes that regular postal workers do too, the ones who are directly employed.
Well, and, you check and find out if they have a felony on their record, but these are not people who are committing their lives to a career. I've known a number of postal employees over my lifetime, you know, not only as, you know, just living long enough to get to know your local postman or postwoman, but also I have friends who've worked for the post office. And these folks think of this as a career. This isn't just, you know, hey, I think I'll take a job for a while doing this, and I don't happen to be a criminal.
I don't disagree with that. Postmen are among the, you know, the most. They're constantly rated the most trustworthy government agency, and they the postal
so
workers.
So why break it up? Just because some corporation wants to make some money?
No, I think actually that consumers have a lot to gain from looking to open up the postal market. The Postal Service is famously opaque in terms of what it reveals to the public, how it reveals its spending, and things of that nature. And
so we should turn the Postal Service over to to the so-called free market, to private enterprise, the same way we have our healthcare system. We now have a healthcare system in the United States where healthcare costs twice as much as it does anywhere else in the world, and yet, you know, 47 million of us aren't served. I mean, the whole idea of the Postal Service was, no matter where you live, you're not going to have to pay more. No matter how hard it may be, no matter what the weather is like, no matter, you know, all those things that in the so-called free market would say, no, hey, you live out in the boondocks, you're going to pay an extra 20 cents because it's going to be more expensive for us to get out there. We said, no, as a nation, we're going to average all this stuff. It's because it's all the commons. This is for all of us. And if we start privatizing this, I see it as disintegrating.
Well, the fact remains, though, that it's illegal for anyone but the U.S. Postal Service to deliver mail, and so we don't know if anyone is able to deliver it at a more competitive rate. European countries have begun experimenting with opening up their postal markets to competition, and consumers have benefited without losing the universal service.
Some European countries have, and by and large, where they've done that, they've done it in large part around packages because they want the country to be able to compete and get more of the revenue that is going to like DHL and FedEx and UPS.
Well, that's true to a degree, but for example, in Britain, they just liberalized the postal market for non-urgent letters, those with that, you know, way that you would send to your grandma or something like that. And consumers can choose from 20 some competitors who are licensed to participate, Royal Mail still maintains the universal service obligation. So
and I predict that in Britain they're going to see it work just as successfully as when they privatized the rail system, and all of a sudden it started falling apart.
I don't know much about the rail system, but I do know that some studies have shown that consumers have benefited to the tune of prices declining 20 to 25% in Europe.
Well, sure. Over the short term, you may see some benefit there. But, you know, the bottom line is the post office is not a profit-making enterprise. There's no Bill Gates of the postal industry. You can't buy into the Postal Service and get dividends every year. And when we privatize it, you're going to have private corporations who are going to have those kinds of overheads. They're going to have CEOs who want to take home a big paycheck. They're going to have stockholders who want their dividend payments. And if they don't get them, they're not going to buy the stock and the company's going to fail. And you know, so we're going to have somebody skimming the cream off the delivery of the mail. And it just seems to me inappropriate. It seems to me that this is part of the commons. Our Postal Service, our ability to know that if I put a stamp on something and drop it in a mailbox, it's going to appear on the other side of the country a day or two or 3 days later or whatever it may be, and predictably, reliably, safely, consistently. I mean, from the founding of this country until today, we have had an absolutely safe and stable postal service. And I'm very concerned that there are folks like you out there advocating that we start dismantling it.
Yeah, but government already is skimming the cream off, to borrow your phrase. For example, only 60% of the costs that it spends in a given year are attributed to a specific purpose. 40% of those go to a general overhead category. So when stamp prices go up in May again, for the second time in a year, consumers have a right to demand where their money is going.
Well, I have no problem with saying, you know, we'd like to see a cleaner audit of the Postal Service, but that, you know, as a government agency, you can do that. You can file a Freedom of Information Act filing and say, I want to know where this money is, and Congress has oversight over this. But a private corporation can say, nah, sorry, we have trade secrets. You can't see our books.
Well, that's just simply not true. I mean, the accounting practices that the Postal Service practices would fall afoul of every single regulation that has recently been passed for private corporations in the wake of an Enron or a WorldCom. If you think about it, the Postal Service is actually cooking its books in much the same way that an Enron or a WorldCom.
Well, then let's clean that up. Let's not, though, turn it over to Acme Widget Company.
That's fine. The Postal Service isn't going to be privatized tomorrow. You and I both know that. But I think that consumers have a right to demand accountability from the Postal Service. And as long as the Postal Service has no competition, there will be very little incentive beyond a few people making phone calls saying my mail didn't get
there. No, Robbie, you're missing the point. You're missing the point. When you talk about the commons, when you're talking about things like our roads, I mean, there's no competition for our roads, our fire departments. There's no competition for our fire departments, our police departments. There's no competition for our fire departments. Competition isn't the thing that drives excellence. The thing that drives excellence when you're talking about our commons is accountability to we the people, because we the people own this government. We the people elect our elected officials. And if our elected officials are running these services in a bad and incompetent way, we throw their butts out. That's why you've got legislators who are worried about potholes.
I don't disagree with you, but no one is standing up.
Then you're contradicting yourself.
No one is standing up and saying that the Postal Service should be more accountable to consumers.
Well, then maybe it's because it's working fine.
I don't necessarily think that's true.
I'm happy with it.
Well, that's not to say that things could not be better. I think that there are a lot of improvements that can be made. I mean, it's relatively ridiculous.
Robbie, this seems to me like, you know, let's do vouchers as schools. It's the camel's nose under the tent. It's the way of just like vouchers are a kind of sideways attempt to destroy public education. It seems to me like, well, let's partially privatize the post office as a way to begin dismantling the post office. Hey, it's another part of the commons that a whole bunch of us in the corporate world can make some money on.
I'm not here to talk about education or the commons. I'm here to talk about the problems that the Postal Service has and the advantages that introducing some level of competition into the postal market can.
But that's my point.
Bring.
The Postal Service is the commons, and there shouldn't be competition in or for the commons. Yeah, don't you get the difference between market stuff? I want my shoemakers and my television makers and my computer makers to be competing with each other. I don't want my fire department or my police department or my post office to be competing with anybody. I want them to be accountable to me and do the single function that they're designed to do.
But the way that you can guarantee that the Postal Service is most accountable is by allowing you to take your dollars and vote with them elsewhere. If you're
No, the way that they're accountable is by having my politicians have oversight over them, and if my politicians aren't doing a good job, every 2 years I get to throw the bums out of office.
Well, unfortunately, the politicians don't really have much say over how much the Postal Service charges for its stamps. Or how it allocates.
The Postal Board of Governors is appointed by politicians.
But that doesn't. The Congress does not vote on rate increases. The Postal Board of Governors does, and they're an independent agency. They operate without any real oversight.
But they are,
I think that's a big problem.
Okay. People can read all about it over at lexingtoninstitute.org. We'll leave you with the last word there. Robbie Shrum from the Lexington Institute. Thanks, Robbie.
Thank you.
Good talking to you. Welcome back to listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman Program, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors and our affiliated radio stations, letting them know you're listening and buying their products and encouraging people in your community to sponsor your local progressive station, as well as the 200,000 health and hospital workers of SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care, because health care in the United States should be a right, not a privilege. Part of the commons. You get it? The whole thing, this whole thing is about the commons. And this is a concept that has been so lost in the United States over the last three decades, by and large, since Reagan came in, Reagan with his, absolutely bizarre, I mean, here he is.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And everybody went, yeah, hey, he must be right. But they expect the mail to go through. We expect our court systems to work. We expect our currency to work. I mean, before Bush, we expected FEMA to work. Before Reagan, we expected our public education system to work. I mean, we've had 28 years now of conservatives dismantling the commons. And it's time for us to say no. It's time for us to say stop. It's time for us to say enough already. Speaking of enough already, our conservative alert for the day. This, a Fox News talk show host. I'm sorry, I've never heard this guy, but apparently he's out there and around the country. Tom Sullivan comparing Barack Obama to Adolf Hitler?
Before the break, the caller just before the bottom of the hour said the Barack Obama speech reminds him of hearing the speeches of Adolf Hitler. So, ladies and gentlemen, from the past, a little archive, a little walk down Der Fuhrer's memory lane, here he is, the one, the only, Adolf Hitler.
Wir wollen, dass dieses Volk ein friedliebend und aber auch tapferes und ihr müsst friedfertig sein.
Yay! Great, I don't know what he said. Here's Barack Obama.
Virginia, this is our moment. This is our time. And if you will stand with me on Tuesday, if you will vote for me.
Yeah, enough already. So Tom says, yeah, Barack Obama and Hitler, yeah, they sound just alike. And then a caller calls him up and says, hey, wait a minute. What are you doing here?
People like him.
I love him. I love his speech. I told you I sat there and I went, I'm listening to his speech.
Why would you bring Hitler in on it?
The caller brought Hitler in on it. Oh. Caller said he sounds like Hitler.
And why would you even pick it up? It's denigrating his character.
No, it's not.
Well, Hitler had nothing to do with what's right and honorable and what the country should be looking forward to.
Amen. So, Tom Sullivan, our pathetic conservative of the day. Let's just leave it at that. 24 minutes past the hour, coming up on 25 minutes past the hour. And our phone number, 1-866-303-2270. Don in Delaware. Don, you're a letter carrier.
Yeah, I've been a letter carrier 16 years, and your guest had a lot of things wrong. We do have competition. The post office can't give discounts like FedEx can on bulk deliveries. People complaining about 42 cents for a stamp. Wait until if it's privatized, how much it'll go up, and you wouldn't get deliveries out in the rural areas every day.
That's right. That's right. I mean, this is the thing. We have averaged it across the United States. So you could say, well, hey, it doesn't make any sense that I should pay 42 cents to deliver a letter to somebody who lives down the street from me as opposed to across the country. Well, yeah, unless you consider it part of the commons and you say, okay, we're all going to average it so that people who live way out in the country, so that somebody up in the boondocks in Alaska can get a letter from somebody in Florida just as easily as I can send a letter here from Portland to my daughter or my son here in Portland. Right across town. I mean, this is the commons we're talking about here.
He brought up about England. Now, they're going to close the rural post offices in Scotland and have a mobile post office, so they'll only have postal facilities maybe once a week or every few weeks.
Right.
Hey, one other quick thing for you.
Yeah.
When you were talking about with the conservatives, I had an English friend who just passed away. He was in his 70s. He said when in England, when the Labour Party was in charge, they gave subsidies to the buses, you know, the city buses that would go out in the rural areas. And unemployment was low. When the conservatives came in, they took away all these subsidies and took away these bus routes that didn't get many people. And they couldn't understand why the unemployment rate then went up, because now people couldn't get into the city to go to work.
Yeah, and this is what Franklin Roosevelt did, by the way, and the same thing. The electric companies back in the 30s, as we were electrifying America, they said, it's just too expensive to run the electric lines out into rural areas, and so we're not going to electrify America. And Roosevelt said, you sure are. And he passed the Rural Electrification Act, which in part gave subsidies to make it happen, but also in part said, if you don't do this, you're going to jail. You're going to lose your company. And then later they had to do the same thing with telephony or telephony or however you say it, with the telephone, variation on the REA. And this is the commons. Frankly, I think all electricity in the United States should be provided by publicly owned utilities, as it is in most communities in the United States, rather than somebody making a buck off that like Enron did. 866-303-2270, our telephone phone number, 27 minutes past the hour.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Hey, it's President's Day, where we're remembering the birthdays of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. And in that context, Lincoln was very, very fond of the Declaration of Independence. He loved to quote it. And, of course, George Washington fought a war based on it. And so I thought, before we pick up your calls here, which we'll do in just a second, I just wanted to share with you the first four or five sentences of the Declaration of Independence, because it is something that every school child in America should memorize. This is, in fact, I remember back in the 60s, there was a study that was done where they took it around to people. They stopped people in shopping malls and said, who do you think was the author of this? The majority of people said Karl Marx. You know, they thought it was some kind of communist document or something. But here it is. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinion of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. When a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such a government and to provide new guards for their future security. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Karen in Washington State. Hey, Karen, what's on your mind today?
I just wanted to add it's interesting to note that since business is so wonderfully efficient in running things, why did England just have to nationalize a bank?
Yeah, among other things. I think, you know, they've got terrible problems with their rail system. And yeah, absolutely. I am not in favor of nationalized banks, by the way. England.
Neither am I.
The reason that they had to nationalize it is the same reason that we bailed out the SNLs. You know, Bush Sr. deregulated the SNL industry, and within a couple of years, we had a whole bunch of people making billions of dollars, including his son, Neil. He didn't make billions, but making a whole bunch of money with Silverado, SNL.
Yeah.
And you had the average person getting screwed, and so $500 billion of taxpayer dollars had to go to bail out the bankers. Then you got Bush Jr. deregulating the mortgage industry back in 2000, 2001, 2002, and cutting red tape and not enforcing regulations, and now we're going to have to bail out the mortgage industry. And you're absolutely right. The same thing happened in the UK because everybody has been embracing this. Oh, yeah, Tom Friedman, he's right. It's the olive and the Lexus tree. The world is flat. Let's all just give it all over to the transnational corporations. Sorry, doesn't work. Very destructive. Dale in Nebraska. Hey, Dale, what's up?
Tom, great show. One other piece to the pie, I think, when we're talking about taxes on the middle class and everything, and I'm referring to the special on Denmark that I watched last night,
Yeah. Is
not only taxes, but if we look at the working class people, I don't really think we can define ourselves as the middle class anymore, but when we factor in taxes that is being taken off of people's paychecks as well, some at very, very high interest rates, it's pretty disheartening for a lot of people because of taxes that they're paying and interest going to the bankers. So if we were to total all that up, the deductibles, co-pays, and everything else, I would think that we're well above the 50% mark.
Yeah, you're suggesting, as an earlier caller did, and I agree with it, that we should rightly consider all of these things, like all of the profit in the healthcare industry that we're having to pay for, as essentially a tax. It's part of the cost of being here, and it's essentially a tax. Yeah, good point, Dale. Thanks a lot for the call. Bruce in California. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I want to make a couple of points about the post office. Well, I guess 3 points. First of all, that there is almost no sentiment in Congress to privatize post office. The best the right wing can do. I mean, it's interesting to me that Bush went after all these government institutions but failed to go after the post office. I was wondering why. You know, I was thinking about this, and I realized that he knows that there's absolutely no sentiment for this in Congress. what the post office last year tried for about the 25th time to end Saturday deliveries, and it was such a hue and cry for the public. 2 weeks later, they dropped the proposal.
Yeah.
That's the first point.
Yeah.
The second point is that Congress has required the post office to run its operations like a business. It must make a profit. If it doesn't make a profit, it must become accountable for that and take whatever remedies have to be, they have to take to make a profit.
That's not so much to make a profit, but at least to break even.
Break even. Exactly.
Yeah.
The third thing is the whole thing. We have a model for what happens when a private carrier takes over when the post office is privatized in New Zealand. Okay. In New Zealand, what happened was that the private carriers claimed for years they could deliver the mails cheaper than the National Post Office. So when they took it over, this was about 3 or 4 years ago, the first thing they did was take out all the collection boxes, except in high-volume business areas.
Right.
So if you wanted to deliver your mail, you can't deliver to a collection box. You have to go to the post office to do that.
Right. Yeah, and it was a miserable failure in New Zealand is the bottom line. And that's the thing. I mean, the post office is not designed to be efficient. The post office is part of the commons. The post office's job is not to be efficient. It's to deliver the mail. And they do that quite well. But, there are going to be areas where you're not going to have a high volume of mail that would, if your only motive was profit, that would justify having a post box there. Does that mean people shouldn't have access to a drop-off, that you shouldn't have a delivery person coming? No, come on, give me a break. Baji in New Mexico. Hey, Baji. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure, hi.
I wanted to talk about what you were, about the changing conditions of in terms of more poverty and how that's affecting young children and their families.
Yeah.
I have worked in early childhood for 35 years, and I see that there are increased challenging situations for children and young children and their families due to the things that you were talking about. And I think a solution to that is to invest in high-quality early childhood education, home visiting, supports for families, and all kinds of things, child care assistance so that the working poor are able to have high-quality early childhood education.
Yes.
So there are lots of solutions out there, and what we need now is to build the will and to put our money where our mouth is. We all love children.
You're absolutely right, Baji. And this is not rocket science. These are not new solutions. These are things we know that Head Start works. We know that reducing poverty works. We know now the neurobiology of poverty, how neurologically destructive to the development of children's brains under the age of three. These are not kids who the conservatives can say, well, I made the choice to be poor. No, we're talking babies. And poverty in their family is inhibiting the development of the intellectual and emotional parts of their brain and strengthening the violent parts of their brain. Because there's stress in the family, not even necessarily violence in the family, just fear that I won't have a job next year, fear that I won't have a home, fear that it's amazing. Charles in New Jersey. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine.
I want to thank you for your service to our country.
Thank you.
I'm calling because on the healthcare issue, a couple of things that come to mind. I told you, Screener, I have a chronic condition. I was in the hospital. Just the medication. Forget the ancillary services that the hospital had to give to me. Just the medication itself, if I had to pay full list price, was $25,000.
Wow.
So if I had no health care coverage, I would have had to pay $25,000. Luckily for me, I have a job that has excellent health care.
Yeah.
35 years ago, I was a student in Paris. I got sick. I went to the American Hospital in Neuilly, and again, I did not pay a dime for my coverage.
Yep.
And finally, there is great service at the National Institutes of Health. Because of the rareness of my condition, I got a referral down there. I was treated like a prince.
Yeah.
I had someone.
Good point. I've got to move along, Charles. Thank you very much for the call. But excellent point. And most of the drugs that are being sold right now by the pharmaceutical companies were developed in most cases in university research funded by the National Institutes of Health. Your and my tax dollars driving a huge for-profit industry. 45 minutes past the hour.
Well, I know the heart of life is gay. Pain fills your heart to the ground. Love turns the whole thing around. Fear is a friend who's misunderstood. But I know.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour, 866-303-2270, tomhartman.com. If you want to participate in our blog or visit our live chat room, I hang out there during the breaks. And Kevin in Beaverton, Oregon. Hey, Kevin, listening on KPOJ. What's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing, man?
I'm fine.
Listen, I have kind of a comment and a brief question. You know, I was listening to this election, and all McCain talks about is the war and securing the borders, but he never addresses, you know, the continuing challenges of the middle class and poor in this country. So I wanted to get your take on how our candidates, Hillary and Obama, could exploit that to hopefully secure the candidacy or the nomination for the presidency.
Yeah. I think that the right across the board in America, and thank you for the call, it's an excellent one. Right across the board in America, Americans want the European dream. I mean, the European dream right now is what used to be called the American dream. And Americans have had 28 years now of, okay, we're going to recalibrate the American dream to, if you hit the lottery, you're happy. Right? No. We'd like the European dream. We'd like to have a national health care program that really works. We'd like to have early childhood education available to everybody. We'd like to eliminate poverty in this country. We'd like to make we'd like to make higher education part of public education so you can get a PhD, you can become a medical doctor. We'd like to stop the AMA's limit on the number of people who can become medical doctors. And I mean, Cuba is exporting doctors. What? Well, because anybody who's intellectually competent can become a physician there. And a lot of people are becoming doctors, and they're sending them all over the world. And look at all the benefits they're getting from this. It's a PR bonanza. And they're making life better for people. What's our main export? Weapons. Our weapons industry. We hold these big conferences. We've got weapons. In answer to how should we handle John McCain, I think the American people are ready for a message of hope. They're ready for a message of change. They're ready for a message of competence. They're ready for a message of here are the specific things that we're going to do to turn America back into the America that our parents knew, back into the America that was envisioned by our founders, an America where everybody has access to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, an America where the welfare, the general welfare defined in the preamble of the Constitution is actually provided for. And point out that John McCain doesn't give a damn about most of those things, and certainly his corporate contributors don't, and try to elect a Democrat who does. It's just, I don't think that it'll be a difficult challenge unless you get some of these Democratic consultants in here who are taking all kinds of money from big corporations and screwing it up again like they have been ever since Dukakis. James in El Sobrante, California, is that right?
That's correct.
Hey, James, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to say keep taking on those libertarians and keep pointing out the difference between corporations today and from the beginning of this country because, you know, in my opinion, a corporation is just another type of government, and they want to run things in Iraq right now.
Yeah, although it's not really another type of government. A corporation is a kingdom. At least government in the United States is democracy. Corporations are not democratic. So I guess I'll give you, it is another kind of government. It's a kingdom. Okay. As you were saying.
So, I want to let people know about a website called www.handsoffirakioil.org.
Mm-hmm.
This weekend, conveniently, since most people don't work on Saturdays, I guess, on Saturday, the February 23rd. People are going to be going out. This is a group actually in London is organizing this, but there's also organized events across cities in the United States where people are going to go out basically to some of the stations with the oil companies that want to be manage all the production of the oil, you know, in Iraq.
Hands off IraqiOil.org. Yeah, it sounds it's a good one. James, thank you very much for sharing that and you know, letting us know. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about political language.
Mm-hmm.
You refer to what we the people collectively own. The rabid right interprets that as collectivism, a synonym for socialism.
Right.
This weekend, Sean Hannity called Bernie Sanders a socialist.
Well, Bernie Sanders calls himself a socialist.
Oh, he does?
Yeah, he calls himself a democratic socialist, the same way that the parties that run most of the European countries where life is so good and people are happy call themselves democratic socialists.
Well, of course, Sean Hannity was using that to denigrate him.
Yeah, and I think we need to rescue some of these words like socialist and liberal and whatnot and say, you know, no, these are, you know, the founders of this country were liberals. That George Washington said, I hope I shall ever see America at the forefront of liberality. These guys called themselves liberals. The Enlightenment was referred to as the liberal Enlightenment in the 16 and 1700s. We need to rescue these words. You're absolutely right, Bernice. Thank you very much for the call. Jeremy in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Jeremy. No Jeremy? Okay, let's go to Charles in Carmel Valley, California. Hey, Charles, listening on KRC.
Hi. Hello.
Hey, Charles.
How you doing?
Great, but we're just about out of time here. Quick
okay,
one.
Okay. Yeah, I think the main problem with the Democratic Party is they have no persistence in their argument. They don't repeat things like the Republicans do. They don't get their message across. And that's the main difference. You know, there's no talking points that the Democrats put out every day. Like, for example, why not designate 1 week for anti-caging, like next week or something like that?
Yeah. And or 1 month or 1 year. Let's take back our, let's get rid of the voting machines and let's take back the mechanism of voting like every other country in the world votes on paper ballots. I mean,
Let me say one other thing before our time gets up.
Yeah. Our time is up. But you're spot on. I absolutely agree with you. The Democrats are not good at messaging, which is why I wrote Cracking the Code, not to shamelessly plug the book, but that's what it's out there. And George Lakoff is doing good writing in this area. They really need to start paying attention to these issues. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Well, the insanity of our brought to you by the pharmaceutical companies Medicare Part D program, this whole drug program that Billy Towson pushed through Congress and then retired early so he could get a job as the chief guy for pharma, the lobbying organization for the big pharmaceutical industry, which is arguably the most profitable industry in the United States. One of the great wonders of this was that the government cannot negotiate drug prices. Therefore, pharma makes a huge profit, an absolutely mind-boggling profit. And on top of that, we can't import drugs into the United States. Now, remember a couple of years ago, I mean, Bernie Sanders started this out. I lived in Vermont at the time that this happened, 8-10 years ago, something like that. And Bernie was organizing bus tours. People would all over in cities all over Vermont. People would, get on every Saturday. Mostly elderly people would get on the bus and they'd go to up to Montreal and hit the pharmacies and buy their drugs. And the federal government, in a variety of ways, put the kibosh on it. And people were buying drugs from Canadian pharmacies via the internet. And the federal government. Right now, if you get drugs in the mail coming from Canada, odds are your package will be opened. It may be confiscated. I mean, in some areas, this could be considered a crime. And the rationale that they gave us was, we're not trying to protect drug company profits. We just know that if it's made here in the United States, it's safe and reliable. And if it's not made here in the United States, it's not. So we're not going to let you import it. My dad, before he died, one of the drugs he was on, he had had a couple of strokes and a couple of heart attacks. And one of the drugs he was on was a blood thinner, heparin. Turns out in the last couple of weeks, a bunch of people died from heparin. Why? Because the heparin sold in the United States, not the heparin that you would buy from Canada, apparently, but the heparin sold in the United States was actually made in China by a company that wasn't even licensed to do pharmaceuticals, and it was contaminated, it was poisonous, it is killing people. It's like, where, you know, what kind of disconnect is this? I mean, here, unsafe drugs from China, Bridgestone and Firestone using child labor. We'll be talking about that in the next segment with Tim Newman from the International Labor Rights Forum. And then get into your thoughts on these issues. And, should we be using the power of government to do the will of big corporations, the big pharmaceutical industry, or should we be using the power of government to advance the interests of the people of the United States of America, to do what's best for we the people, for all of us, we the people? I mean, this seems like a fairly straightforward equation. In Denmark and Sweden and Norway and Great Britain and France, I mean, all over the world, they get it. Now, use the power of government to advance the needs of the people. It is about the commons. It's not a marketplace. It's the commons. There's a difference. There's an appropriate place for each, but there's a difference. The marketplace, you go out in the marketplace, it's where you buy things, you sell things. I mean, it's the marketplace. The commons are the stuff that we all collectively own. And we need to make sure that we don't destroy it, because it's the stuff that's essential for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That we all, the air that we're all breathing, the water we're all drinking, arguably the natural monopolies like the electricity that we use, and our healthcare system. And so here, when the Republicans had control of the House, the Senate, and the White House, they pushed through this legislation that said, oh, no, you cannot, if you want to bring heparin in from Canada, you can't do that. It might not be safe. While at the exact same time, they're whispering to their buddies in the pharmaceutical industry, hey, psst, you bring the stuff in from China, we'll give you tax breaks. We're going to do away with the tariffs. And so now a lot of Americans are looking at this and saying, wait a minute. I'm not supposed to bring in drugs from Canada because they may not be safe. But the pharmaceutical companies in the United States are bringing in the ingredients for the drugs that they're selling me from China. Haven't we learned from lead in toys? I mean, at what point do we as Americans say, okay, enough already, we're starting to figure this out? There was a really good reason why for 220 years in the United States we had a national industrial policy. There was a really good reason why for a couple of hundred years in the United States, right up until basically Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Reagan, we had trade policies, industrial and trade policies that protected American jobs. That John Edwards' parents, the mill workers, were able to be mill workers because they didn't have to compete with somebody in China willing to work for a dollar a day, or somebody in Bangladesh willing to work for 80 cents a day. They didn't have to compete with that person because we had, frankly, barriers to trade. You want to call it that? That's what it was. Barriers to kinds of trade that would destroy American jobs. On the other hand, we had open doors to trade that would build American jobs. And this is how it's done in most countries around the world. If General Motors wants to sell a car in China right now, they have to pay a 20% import tax to the Chinese government to import that car into China. Why? Because the Chinese are saying, we want to build our own domestic auto industry. If Walmart were to go into India today and say, we're going to start building, we're going to franchise Walmarts or build Walmarts all across India, any executive who tried to do that in India would be put in prison. Because the Indian government has looked at their retail sector stores, right? The retail sector, they've looked at the retail sector and they've said, it is essential that this be local, diversified, and therefore strong. Now you can make the case, oh, well, Walmart would make it even more strong. It'd make it more profitable. And they probably would. They would extract more profit that would go to Little Rock, Arkansas, and into the pockets of the five heirs of Sam Walton. But India said, no, we want the retail sector to be local. And so right now the law in India is that you cannot own multiple stores. You can't do it. 98% of all retail businesses in India right now are locally owned. It is literally the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker. They're local, and they're responsible to the people, to the local people. They're responsive to the local people that they're selling to. So if somebody is selling bad goods, hey, everybody knows who they are. They know where they live. It used to be that way in the United States. One of the reasons why CEOs only made 30 times what everybody else made, because they had to live in the same community. Their kids went to the same schools. They had to look in the faces of their workers. People knew each other. People were responsible to each other. But with this whole Friedmanism, both Milton and Thomas, this whole idea of, oh, well, the world is flat and we don't have to worry about us. We just need to turn it over to the transnational corporations. It's 1,000 points of light after all. It's a new world order. And who does it benefit? It benefits a small number of very, very powerful and wealthy families, the new landed gentry in America, that the founders sought not to have. You know, the first person after the founding of this country, there were multimillionaires in today's dollars in the United States before the Revolution. None of the founders were multimillionaires. The wealthiest among them was John Hancock. His net worth was, in today's dollars, probably around $700,000. But there were. There was like the Johnson family up in the Mohawk Valley, up in northern New York State. They had this giant castle. And warriors who were like, you know, the Knights of the Round Table. And they had, you know, both Africans and Indians that they had hired and people that they'd brought over from Europe. And they had chain mail and the whole bit, right? Armor. They fled the country. The millionaires were mostly loyal to, they were the ones who didn't want there to be a Revolutionary War. They fled the country to Canada. The Johnson family went to Canada. Others went to other countries after the Revolution. And the first person in the United States to make $1 million in today's dollars was in the 1790s. We said in the founding of this country, a corporation cannot exist for more than the lifetime of a person, 20, 30, or 40 years, depending on the state, so that it will have to go essentially through probate. So it can't be a vehicle for infinitely accumulating wealth. We instituted an inheritance tax so we'd no longer have the landed gentry like we fought against in England. And welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Tim Newman is on the line with us. He's the campaigns assistant with the International Labor Rights Forum, laborrights.org and stopfirestone.org, their websites. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you with us. We've been talking throughout the program, actually, for the last 2.5 hours about some of the just general insanity that's going on, not just in the United States, but all around the world. In the notions of the commons and the notions of the private enterprise and how private enterprise, to quote Franklin Roosevelt, has become too private and has become privileged enterprise. And now you're documenting how Bridgestone and Firestone are using child labor.
Yes, that's right. So we have a campaign that's going internationally. And it's focused on a rubber plantation in Liberia that's owned by Firestone. And Firestone is owned by Bridgestone, which is actually a Japanese company. And a lot of the rubber is tapped by children in Liberia that ends up in tires that we consume here in the U.S.
Hmm. And so, you know, tell me, how does this chain work? I mean, how is it that a U.S. are these U.S.-based corporations, first of all?
Yes. So Firestone is Bridgestone Firestone is the world's largest tire company. And Firestone here in the U.S. is a huge company. They're making millions of dollars. And basically, they've owned this rubber plantation in Liberia since 1926. And the way that, you know, rubber works is that it's tapped from trees, and the latex kind of drips from the tree, and then it's processed into rubber. So it's kind of like a maple tree dripping.
I thought all rubber these days was made from petroleum. I didn't realize that they were still making rubber from rubber
trees.
Yeah,
they are, definitely. At least in Liberia, they are, yes. And so what happens is that all of the workers on this plantation owned by Firestone, they have a daily quota that they're supposed to meet, a production quota. And if they don't meet that quota, then their wages, which are already about a little over $3, will be halved. So as a result, they're kind of forced to bring their children to work in order to meet that quota, because the quota is very high, and we've done the math, and it would take about 21 hours for an average person to actually meet that production quota.
So they bring their children in to work alongside them?
That's right, and often they also bring their wives as well. And the problem is that the wives and the children are not formal employees, so they don't have access to the same benefits, and they're not paid outside of the wage that's given to the you know, head of the household.
And the products of this child labor, I'm not sure I'd quite call this slave labor, but it's damn close. Let's say at the very least, inappropriate labor practices, the products of this end up here in the United States?
Exactly. So a lot of it ends up in our tires. There are also some other products like hoses and some roofing materials and stuff like that, but the majority of it does end up in our tires.
Yeah, it seemed marine hoses was one of the things that was identified in the article you sent me.
Yeah.
So this, you know, back in the days when we had slave labor in the United States, you know, people correctly and appropriately, I think, condemned Thomas Jefferson for holding slaves. He looked in the face of his slaves. He acknowledged that. And frankly, he fought most of his life to end slavery, although it's not the story that most people know about him. First piece of legislation he introduced into the House of Burgesses was to end slavery in Virginia. And you know, got into the Constitution what he thought was going to be the end of slavery in 1800. But nonetheless, he didn't, but he looked in the face of his slaves. I would submit to you, Tim Newman, that what we're seeing here is that we never ended slavery in the United States. We simply exported it.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, you and I are no longer looking in the faces of our slaves. We're buying the products of their work, but we don't have to deal with them. They're not in our neighborhood, and they're not even in our country. So we feel comfortable to ignore it.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think there's a strong case to be made there. And I think that, you know, we work on a number of different industries. I also work on the chocolate industry, and that's another similar case where we don't kind of think of where the raw materials for the products we consume come from. And a lot of that is made in the global south under conditions that, you know, we would find unacceptable.
Right, and coffee as well in some cases.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, there's, and frankly, any kind of agricultural product. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the United States, I mean, just Bernie Sanders last Friday was telling us how they just busted a ring down in Florida that was actually using slaves.
Exactly. Immokalee workers in Florida are another great example of you know, really exploitative working conditions that end up in our supply chain.
So at laborrights.org and stopfirestone.org, we're talking with Tim Newman, who's the campaigns assistant for the International Labor Rights Forum, our labor segment for the week. What can people do? What can we do about this, Tim?
Well, you know, there's a lot to be done, and I think we're gaining a lot of momentum in our campaign right now. So one thing that happened recently that was really interesting is that the City Council of Berkeley actually passed a resolution expressing solidarity with the workers, the Firestone workers in Liberia, and, you know, embracing kind of our campaign demands. So that's something that people could take to their local cities. A lot of cities have contracts with Firestone for, like, police cars, for the tires, and things like that. So that's something that folks could do. You could also do something more simple, which is just check out stopfirestone.org. You can send an email. You can send letters to.
How about political action? How about saying that, you know, we're going to impose like a 300% tariff on the import of any product that's been found to have child or slave labor in it?
Yeah, there have been some experiments with things like that because, I mean, really, these products should not be entering the U.S. if they're made under these conditions.
Yeah, I think, that, you know, this should be an issue of law. I think people should be contacting their legislators as well. Tim Newman, The website, laborrights.org, stopfirestone.org. Check them out. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. You see this story in the news? It's now spreading all over the news. It was first reported by ABC's Channel 13 in whatever the city was where this first happened. I don't have that in my notes here. But Chris Pickle is the local reporter about these cows that were forced to walk, using things like, bulldozers to get these cows to walk across this line. Because if the cow could walk across the line, then it was considered healthy. And if it couldn't, it might have mad cow disease or something like that. Or it might have cancer or some other disease. And they were, like, cattle prodding them.
Undercover video from the Humane Society shows workers tormenting cows, prodding, dragging with chains, spraying with water, even ramming with forklifts.
The attempt was to make them so distressed and to cause them so much suffering that these animals would get up and walk into the slaughterhouse.
And that's the bottom line. Because the rule was if you could walk across the line, then you were a healthy animal. And if you couldn't, then it had to be reported. And again, another example, here we have over the last 15 years, the number of inspectors, USDA inspectors, has been cut. We've been cutting back particularly on a per capita basis. And, as our population grows and more meat is being consumed and more animals are being slaughtered, fewer and fewer inspectors. Why? Oh, well, it's the wonders of the free market. Haven't you read Tom Friedman? Sorry. See, this is the problem with libertarian philosophy. Yes, there is some truth to the notion that when businesses are inappropriate, when businesses are fraudulent, when businesses are doing wrong things, eventually people find out and they don't want to buy from that business anymore. There is some truth to that, and it works actually quite well with small local businesses. I remember living in Montpelier, Vermont, and there was a local doctor in town who was lousy, and the word traveled, and he didn't have any business. He moved. Number one, in a nation where everything is nationwide, I have no idea who was the supplier of, well, I don't eat beef, but I mean, who's the supplier of the radishes that I'm eating? I don't know where they came from. How about, first of all, some country of origin labeling? But number two, our food supply, at least some dimension of the safety of our food supply, let's put it that way, is also part of our commons. And it's been subordinated to profit one more time. Amazing. Flo in Sunrise, Florida, listening to WINZ. Hey, Flo, what's up?
Hi, Mr. Hartman.
Good morning.
I love being part of your show.
Or good afternoon in Florida.
Yeah, good afternoon. There was a huge recall on some of that meat where the cattle, they were prodded and forced into the killing machine.
Well, they're having to recall it now because some of those animals may have had mad cow disease or cancer or other diseases.
Well, apparently some of the schools in Florida did get that meat, but they're no longer getting the meat from the that particular plant.
Right, but they already ate it.
Yeah, so I guess, I'm originally calling on the first Kuwaiti company abducted these men. They thought they were going to Dubai to work to get fine jobs, and they ended up in the green zone with little or no work safety things.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't talked about, but the green zone, I mean, isn't that under our rule?
Yeah, it's supposedly. Yeah. Well, actually, it's under the control of the Iraqi government. We have officially, more or less, turned the control of Iraq over to the Iraqis. But the average Iraqi knows that it's not.
Well, the United States could investigate it. Also, in Saipan, I've been talking about this for years, and George Miller was supposed to investigate this because Saipan is Marianas Islands territory of us.
This is where Tom DeLay went out and said this is the perfect
example of what
democracy.
We want our country to be.
Yeah, he said this is a perfect example of how capitalism should work.
Well, they take these young girls over there. If they can't pay back their loan, they force them into prostitution.
Yep.
And almost keep them under lock and key. Bill Moyers had a segment on that.
Yeah,
and what are we doing about that? I call California, call Miller's office to, it's very upsetting to me to think that this is, you know, a lot of things are going on that the American people, it's not happening here to the American people, but it seems to be happening all over the world.
Yep. No, you're absolutely right. Flo, thanks a lot for the call. Spot on and well said. Thank you. Elaine in Hawaii. Hey, Elaine.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to know what can we do about these kind of things where, you know, inferior products are being made by very unhappy workers and children. I had in 1976, I bought my first car. It was a Ford Pinto, and it was equipped with four Firestone 500 tires, every one of them radial tires that just came right off the rims, basically just before the court case was settled, and I had to hold on to all my receipts. And just recently, I bought a CRV, a used CRV, and it had Bridgestone tire on, and the same thing happened. The radials came right off the car.
Wow.
And it would be nice to know about these things before you buy the defective products made by unhappy people.
Yeah, well said, Elaine. Unfortunately, there's no easy answer. I mean, this is where we as a people have to turn to government and say, you know, you guys have a job to do in making sure that this kind of stuff doesn't happen, to making sure that the toys that come into this country, first of all, wouldn't it be better if they were made in this country? But if we are going to bring them in from someplace else, that they don't contain lead or poisons, formaldehyde or, you know, carcinogens and things. And on it goes. I mean, right now, about all we have is Consumer Reports magazine and the internet and some groups like, you know, the labor group that we just had on, Tim Newman and his organization. But broadly, I would say to protect ourselves as consumers, step one, buy local, buy small. Ask, you know, if there's not a label on it, don't trust it. It's like, you know, we're having as consumers to get more and more careful. But Elaine, thank you for the call and for raising the issue. Aaron in Seattle. Hey, Aaron, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you. Let's see. If I could just briefly add to that, I think either Forbes or Fortune magazine, they have something on the cover now that says, how do we break our addiction to child labor? And it's like, oh, wow. You know, oil. We're addicted to oil, addicted to child labor.
Yeah.
You know, what else? Crack and crystal meth.
Well, now we're addicted to foreign money. You know, Reagan, Bush, and Bush have run up, you know, a $4-6 trillion deficit on top of the deficit that we already had, you know, left over from World War II and the Vietnam War. And we're having to bring foreign money in all the time.
But they're just waiting like Bernanke, I guess, as soon as a Democrat gets in. We're going to raise the rates to 11%.
I absolutely think that's what's going on. I think that they are pumping money out. You know, you go back and you look. In 1921, the Fed, which came into being in 1913, in 21, the Fed, under, I guess, Warren Harding was the president, the first Republican after Wilson, right? The Fed dropped interest rates below the rate of inflation, which made it very, very profitable to borrow money and speculate like crazy. And that's exactly what Greenspan did after, you know, after 2000, actually even before 9/11, after Bush was elected, in order to try and really goose the economy. And it created this housing bubble, just like in 1921 it created a stock bubble. And the result of the 21 drop in interest rates down below the rate of inflation was the crash of 29. And I'm telling you, the result of Greenspan dropping interest rates down to where they were a net negative relative to inflation is going to be the crash of 2009 and maybe the crash of 2008. And the Republicans are doing everything they can to hold their fingers in the dike to stop this thing from happening before the election, so that if a Democrat is elected president, and if Democrats pick up more seats in the House and in the Senate, and then they'll pull their fingers out and boom, the whole economy comes crashing down, and they say, see what happens when you elect Democrats, in the hopes that that will be the end of it, that no Democrat will ever be elected again, just like it with the Republicans. I mean, the Republicans up until 1932, the Republicans and Democrats were relatively evenly split in the House of Representatives. By 36, the Republican Party was down to fewer than 100 members of the House. I mean, it just wiped out the Republican Party, the Republican Great Depression. And the Republican Party is hoping that the Republican Great Depression, the Bush recessions and the Bush Depression that they're setting up right now, will be blamed on the Democrats. And frankly, I don't think Americans are that stupid. I really don't. But I guarantee you that's what they're up to. George in L.A., listening on K-Talk. Hey, George.
I don't know if you know it, but the term conservative is so misused because they're really not conservatives and they're not conserving anything. They're big spenders.
You're right.
And, you know,
they're big borrowers, too.
Yeah. I mean, when they say that Democrats are big spenders, they mean they're spending the money on the infrastructure. But it's okay for them to spend money on defense when we have no boogeyman to fight, except the ones that they invent. But the thing is, privatizing the post office is such a joke. Where are you going to get the delivery of your letter first class for 41 cents? If you privatize it, it's just common sense that they're going to raise that price to a dollar. They're going to take all the choice areas, like the cities, and leave the rural areas to their own design.
Right, and the big corporations that have high mail volume, they'll give discounts to, and people like you and me, they'll say, you only do 5 or 6 letters a year? Cost you $2.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what these people are smoking.
They're smoking up rolled-up versions of Tom Friedman's book, The Olive Tree and the Lexus, and his book, The World is Flat. That's
what
they're
smoking. Think that's the Bible. But, the fact is that I don't know if they really believe this deep down or they're after that job. You know, where that'll pay them a couple hundred thousand years to say these stupid things.
I think it may
be reality, if you look in real life, it never did work. It never has worked. So why would you resurrect a failing policy? That's what I can't think of.
Absolutely right. And well said, George. Thank you very much for the call. Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, I do want privatization for the companies that make my shoes and my computer. I want them to compete. But if it has to do with the commons, I want to have a say in it. 45 minutes past the
many years have passed since old summer days. Mom feels the father. See the children run as the sun goes down.
Listener-supported radio. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, including SEIU 1199, the 200,000 health and hospital workers fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because health care should be a right, not a privilege, in these here United States. Kay in Austin, Texas. Hey, Kay, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hi. I'm outraged about the news I saw this morning, and it was more to do with the tainted meat that was sent off to our schools.
Mm-hmm.
It also made its way down here to Texas, and instead of having these cows tested that are falling over that could contain BSE or mad cow disease, they're shipping them into our school cafeterias.
Yep.
I also lived in Germany. I've heard you mention that a few times, and mm-hmm. as you might know, they have the strictest food regulations in the world.
Yep.
And they also had a BSE scare, and now they have every cow counted, numbered, accounted for. They know, you know, every generation of cows that cow came from. We don't do any testing on our cows. This is ridiculous.
Right. In fact, there was a guy who was growing organic beef who wanted to test all of his cows so that he could export to Japan, because the Japanese will not take our exports, and also so that he could report to his customers that, you know, yes, we certified that these cows are BSE free, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or mad cow disease, and the FDA threatened to put him in jail if he did it. Said you can't do that because the big cattle industry, you know, got laws passed saying no, you can't do that. It is nuts.
Is there anything that we can do?
Call your member of Congress. Call your member of Congress. Say virtually every other country in the world is tracking every single animal. Well, number one, you can become a vegetarian, but beyond that,
I won't let my children buy their lunches in the cafeteria, for one thing, any longer.
Oh, yeah. It is crazy to be eating at the top of the food chain right now, given how badly polluted it is. Our fish are filled with mercury. Our factory animals are filled with prion diseases and antibiotics. I mean, it's nuts. Kay, thank you very, very much for the call, and well said. Jim in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Jim.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What's up?
Well, I heard you people talking earlier about the healthcare system and how things might change, and I think it's incorrect to say to lead people to believe that anything will actually happen in that direction, because it would take far too much change in the Congress for anything to ever happen, and I don't think it'll happen in the next generation or two.
Yeah, well, Jim, I respectfully disagree with you. I believe that we are going to see it happen, because I think Americans are just like over it. You may be right, You may be right, but I hope not. Bill in Orange County, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Bill.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm great. What's up?
Listen, 11 years ago, I had a stroke. I was diagnosed with high blood pressure, and I took my medication, and I couldn't afford the medication, so I stopped taking it. So 10 years ago, I had a stroke.
Wow.
And basically, for the good Lord, I'm here today.
Yeah.
But I could not afford the medication. Some friends turned on the drugs in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I have been getting my drugs in Canada for half the price
yeah.
that I could get here. And they leave us alone. They don't. They always ask, you know, when my drugs come, you know, has the package been opened or anything like that. You know, it appears that the post office is just saying this is a need.
Yeah,
you know,
you're getting away with it, Bill, is the bottom line. By the way, are you taking blood thinners like heparin?
No.
Okay, yeah.
No.
I
don't know whether I'm getting away with it or not, but yeah. The fact is, now 4 of my 5 drugs are shipped directly from pharmaceutical companies here in the United States because of the pressure that Canada's put on, you know, what they buy. They could just buy direct and they ship straight to me now.
Yeah.
You know, and when people tell me that, you know, this drug, you know, I remember when they had the Senate hearings, and I was watching C-SPAN,
yeah.
and these guys came up there and had the gall, we're not sure about Canadian drugs. The fact is, life expectancy for a male and a female is a year longer in Canada.
Yeah, where are all the dead Canadians? I mean, I live in Vermont.
Are they dying like flies?
Yeah, they were not dropping like flies and falling all over the border, nor were they coming down to Montpelier to buy their drugs in our drug stores where I lived, which was only two hours south of the Canadian border.
Anyway,
well said, Bill. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Eric in Long Island, listening on WWRL. Hey, Eric.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Your show's very informative. I wish everyone in America was listening to it. But
thank you.
I have a question.
Maybe
I'm
someday.
Not sure if you'll be able to answer or not. We both know that the Pfizer wiretapping has nothing to do with terrorism since he did it before 9/11.
That's right.
But I was wondering if you can speculate, what is Bush's real motive then for why does he even want to wiretap us?
I think part of his motive was political. I think that Karl Rove wanted to know what opposition politicians were doing. I think one of the reasons.
Well, it's not
why...
just politicians. It's ordinary Americans.
Oh, I know. They're wiretapping everybody in sight. But I, you know, frankly, I think that one
why?
Of the side benefits of that. Well, here's where we get into the fringes of conspiracy theory, but I'll toss one out to you, that they wanted to be able to listen into any Democrat they damn well please so that they could know Democratic strategy. I mean, we're talking about Karl Rove said we want a permanent Republican majority. That means single party rule for the rest of the history of the United States. That's like the Politburo. That's like the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. That's what Karl Rove said in public was his goal. So if you do a sweep out there and you scoop up everybody's conversations and you can claim any justification you want. Oh, we're trying to stop terrorism. We're trying to stop pornography. We're trying to stop, you know, fill in the blank. But, you know, I suspect that that part of it that Karl Rove was most interested in was, what's Teddy Kennedy talking about today?
Oh, I see.
You know, what's going on? Because we know that there was a guy in Arlen Specter's office, a kid who was working in, a young man, you know, he was in his 20s, who was working in Arlen Specter's office, who had successfully hacked into Ted Kennedy's computer and a number of the other Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, probably Pat Leahy as well. And every time the Republicans would bring a judicial nominee forward, this guy had hacked into their computers and he was reading their email for a year and a half. And when it finally came out, Arlen Specter fired the guy. No investigation. Coming up tomorrow, libertarian author and talk show host Neil Bortz on his book, Fair Tax, The Truth, Answering the Critics. Oh, yeah. Plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People, where we remind you every day, my friends, activism begins with you, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.